From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Don't get the wrong idea about today's show. We're talking with Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus about a movement they've embraced called minimalism. The basic idea is living a meaningful life with less stuff, ridding yourself of the gadgets and debt and possessions that anchor us down. But Ryan and Joshua don't live the lives of monks. They still have stuff, just much less of it, and it's only the stuff that really matters to them. Because minimalism, they say, looks different for everyone because it's about finding what is essential to you. So it's personal. They'll join us today to explain how minimalism is a tool to live a meaningful life. And really, it comes down to this question. Are you truly happy? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the course of the last several years, Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus have had a few crucial conversations that led them to this movement called minimalism. The first was a conversation when they were high school seniors about what it would take to be truly successful. Money was the answer back then, and by their late 20s, they had plenty. Great jobs, nice cars, big houses, and lots of stuff. But the more money and professional success they had, the more they needed. They've described it as like a cocaine high. And at some point, they realized they were living just to break even emotionally, which led to the next crucial conversation where they asked themselves why it was the stuff wasn't making them happy. And that question has led them to this lifestyle where they strip out the things, the tasks, even the relationships that keep them from living a meaningful life. Which didn't mean that they became hermits, by the way, didn't ditch everything, didn't eschew pleasure or technology. They just tried to get down to the basics in their lives, to the things that really matter. Ryan and Joshua have come to be known as the minimalists, and today on the program we are talking about what it means to live a meaningful life. Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus have two books. The most recent is called Everything That Remains, and guys, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start. I guess we'll get to the story which sort of led you to where you sort of had this epiphany about minimalism. But you trace it way back, this sense of discontent. And I wanted to start there because you go all the way back to when you were 10 years old. Yeah. Growing up, this was in Ohio.
Yeah, Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio. And you say in very dysfunctional households, and I guess this was part of the issue here. It was that you didn't have. I mean, was this dysfunctional sense of your growing up? Was that part of why you weren't exactly sure what happiness was in those days?
I mean, I thought the reason we were discontent growing up is because we didn't have much money. And so I remember the conversation in high school. Ryan and I have known each other since we were fat little fifth graders. And I remember that conversation. We sat down at the lunch table and Ryan figured out the equation for happiness. It was if each of us could make 50 grand a year, then
you'd nailed it to a number, right?
Right. Well, just so you know where that number came from, my father, he's got a little small like painting and wallpaper company, and I worked for him throughout the summers of high school. And we were always working in very affluent homes, like indoor bowling alleys, indoor pools, like really crazy, large, expensive houses. Nothing I ever aspired to really have. But one day we were in this, you know, middle-class home, and everyone in the home seemed really happy. It was a really happy family. The pictures on the wall confirmed that they were really happy. And it was nice and tidy. And I thought, man, this is happiness. And I'm like, Dad, how much do I have to make in order to own a house like this? And he's like, son, if you can make $50,000 a year, you can own a home like this. So that's where the 50 grand came from.
So right after high school, I went and got a sales job. And I figured, you know, I can make 50 grand a year. And I realized that I was making the same bad decisions as we were making when we were poor, though, because when I was making 50 grand, I was spending 65. And so I went back to the drawing board with Ryan and said, hey, man, I don't think this equation is right. I think maybe we need to adjust for inflation.
Yeah.
And so when I started making 65, I was spending 80, and then I was, you know, making six figures and spending more than that. It turned out that those bad decisions were the reason that we were discontent, and I was compulsively consuming, buying things in impulse, finding happiness in this template that wasn't actually bringing me happiness. I was searching for happiness. And so by age 27, I was very ostensibly successful. I was the youngest director in my company's 140-year history. Had all the trappings of success, the six-figure salary, the big house with more bedrooms than inhabitants, the gadgets, the furniture, the appliances, closets filled with clothes, all the stuff. And I realized that most of it wasn't actually adding value to my life. But it took a couple events in my life for that to actually happen.
Let's talk about one of those, which is your mother dies of cancer. Mm-hmm. And this leads you guys, I guess, to another one of these conversations. You keep coming back to each other, it seems like, and having these sort of checkpoint conversations. And you have another conversation about happiness. This is when your mother was going through this cancer. What was what was that conversation like?
Yeah. Well, for me, it was the initial conversation was an internal conversation. Why am I so discontented? Why have I given so much meaning to the material possessions in my life? And what is actually important in my life? Is this what I've been waiting for my entire life? Because I looked around at all of my success, but it didn't feel successful. I was stressed out. I was working 70, 80 hours a week, and I was living to work instead of working to live. And then I found this thing called minimalism. So ultimately, the happiness conversation between me and Ryan had a lot more to do with he saw how happy I was after I had started simplifying my life. I never jumped up and said, oh my gosh, Ryan, you need to become a minimalist because you've got a lot of crap. It was much more about me displaying the benefits that I was experiencing once I was shedding the excess stuff, finding out what was superfluous and sort of getting that out of the way. And not just getting rid of the stuff. I don't think that was the ultimate point. It was making room to figure out what was actually important in my life.
So what were you seeing with Joshua?
Well, he was happier. I mean, he was happier, the happiest I've seen him in a really long time. And it really didn't make sense to me because we were both working at the same corporation. We both climbed the ranks during our 20s. And he was just as miserable as me. and, you know, to boot, he had some terrible events happen in his life where his mom passed away and his marriage ended both in the same month.
Yeah.
So after a couple months, I, you know, noticed this difference in him, and I went to him and I'm like, why are you so happy, man? Like, did they put you on some like antidepressants or what's going on? And he's like, no, it's nothing like that. And he was like, you know, I've really just been figuring out what is important to me, what does make me happy. And I've used this thing called minimalism to help me do that. And he introduced me to an entire community of people who called themselves minimalists, and they were doing the same thing, and they were all different, you know, different backgrounds, families, kids. There was there's a gal here named Courtney Carver.
Yeah.
She's a wife and mother to a teenage daughter. You know, they've got a house and car, and then there's this guy named Colin Wright who he owns like 51 things, travels to a new country every 4 months, which that was the first example I saw. And right away I was like, you know, I kind of like having a kitchen table. I kind of like having a couch or a chair. I like to have people over for dinner. So maybe that's not my flavor of minimalism. But after I went down the rabbit hole and found people like Joshua Becker, who he's got a couple kids and a wife and a full-time job and a car and a house in the suburbs. And then there's this other guy named Leo Babauta.
I want to talk about all these people, by the way, as we go, because you lay out these stories in your book. But I want to come back to that point that you're making, which is important to say that you didn't shave your heads and go to thrift stores to buy clothing and then strip everything completely out. That would be fine, I suppose. I mean, the point is that's not what minimalism is, and that's not what it means, I guess.
Right. Absolutely. This has never been about deprivation. I mean, you or any of your listeners could go home and rent a dumpster and throw all of your stuff away and be completely miserable and, you know, sulk in an empty apartment or house or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it started with a packing party. So when I first, you know, was introduced to this thing called minimalism and this community of people, I'm like, all right, this sounds awesome, man. Like, okay, I'll do it. I'll be a minimalist. Like, now what do I do? I didn't really know. And we had come up with this idea called a packing party where Josh came over to my 2,000 square foot condo, 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, 2 living rooms. I have no idea why a single guy needs 2 living rooms.
He had a cat.
Yeah. So he helped me pack everything up as if I were moving.
Yeah.
And the idea was to unpack things as I needed it for 3 weeks. To kind of really figure out what I was using. So Josh helped me box up everything, my clothes, my kitchenware, my toiletries, my towels, even my furniture. We literally packed up everything.
Yeah.
And then I unpacked day by day as I needed things from those boxes. You know, all the boxes were marked really well, so I know where to go when I needed a particular item. But yeah, so you can imagine that first thing. I unpacked my toothbrush. I'm unpacking my bed and bed sheets. I come home from work the next day. I went like straight to the modem and unpacked the internet. Unpacked, you know, just over the next 21 days. And at the end of this experiment, I had 80% of my stuff still left in boxes. And that was like my huge light bulb moment for 2 reasons. The first reason was I thought, wow, here are all these things that I've bought to make me happy. And they're not doing their job. And then the second light bulb moment was, wow, this was really amazing. I think people will connect with this story. I don't think I'm crazy. Like, this makes sense. So that's where theminimalists.com started, was with this 21-day packing story.
It's interesting. There's the question you put at the beginning of one of your books. It's almost like the epigraph to the book. It says, are you truly happy?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the essential question?
I think, you know, you have to define happiness too, which takes a lot of unpacking, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's such an important question that we need to ask ourselves, because we go around sort of an autopilot all the time and not asking the more important questions. One of the things I figured out was asking better questions yielded much better answers. And they weren't always answers I wanted to hear at first either. Like, I was giving so much meaning to things that weren't really that important, whether they were actual material things or relationships was another big one for me, because all of my time was dedicated to relationships that were birthed out of proximity or convenience. Hmm. What I like to say, history or geography, right? A relationship's been around for a while, so I'll keep that around. Or we work in the same office, or we're networking buddies, clients, customers, whatever. And we didn't have a lot of shared values and beliefs. They weren't bad people necessarily, yeah. But I found that I was dedicating all my time to those people. And then so the people I truly loved, my time was already gone. I didn't have time to spend with them. And so asking those kind of questions, are you truly happy? I wasn't. And I realized that I wasn't, and I knew I needed to fix it.
So I wonder what is at the root of – I mean, you say in the book this. You say conformity is the drug with which many people self-medicate.
Mm. Mm.
What do you mean? We want to conform to what? Just what's expected of us.
Sure. Yeah, it's the weird expectations. Other people's expectations is ultimately what we're conforming to. There's nothing wrong with owning anything, a couch, a TV, whatever. It has to do with the meaning we give to those things. The problem isn't the stuff. The problem is us and thinking we're supposed to buy these things, that keyword being supposed to. We're supposed to fit this particular template. You know, the American dream may not be your dream, or a different version of it may be. And it took a long time for me to realize that. It took, you know, having all of those things to realize that maybe I didn't actually want all those things.
It seems like you say that nearly all of the pressure that we feel is internal, completely internal.
Mm.
That seems like an important insight, I think, for all of this.
Certainly. I think from the first day of school, you know, you're given this pressure to do good enough to go to the next grade, and then you get to the next grade, and then it's more pressure to get to the grade after that, and then, you know, eventually graduate high school, you graduate college, and there's all this pressure that is that is built up. And certainly through the different things we see on TV, the different media we allow into our lives. I know for me, it was the things that I read. It was the people I associated with. It was the TV I watched. It gave me all of that internal pressure. And, you know, I never was really living for the now. I was always living for this future self, this future happy self. And yeah, as I made more money, I spent more money under these internal pressures that I put on myself. And it just got to a point where the pressure kind of built up and it exploded to where I didn't know what was important anymore. And I think a lot of people are facing that. And that's why, you know, we have over 2 million people a year who read our words, because they can connect with that internal pressure.
You know, one of the things you write about was that you sort of did this inventory mm-hmm. early on, and you wanted to identify the anchors, the things that were, I guess, holding you back.
Right.
So after a week, this is really interesting. Joshua, you had 83 anchors. Ryan, you had 54 anchors.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what? Give me a sense of what we're talking about. What were some of the anchors?
Well, we think about that word. And in fact, it's usually used as a compliment.
Yeah.
You're a very anchored person. And thinking about it is turning that over on its head and saying, well, what does that mean? An anchor is what keeps a ship at bay, right, from the sort of the open waters. And what are some of the anchors that I had in my life? I had to start questioning, what is keeping me from being free? What's keeping me from the open sea? And I mean, I realized a lot of it was debt for me. One of the biggest seeds of discontent in my life was debt. I had six figures worth of debt. And so that was difficult. Some of the relationships in my life, some people played the victim role, and victims become victimizers. And other relationships, I realized I wasn't contributing to. I think every relationship is sort of this us box where I'm contributing, they're contributing, we both get something out of it. That's what a relationship is. And in some cases, I was just taking and not giving as much as I should be. And so that many relationships in my life were anchors, or I was an anchor in someone else's life. And I had to realize there were a lot of things that were keeping me from being free. Working 70, 80 hours a week just to maintain a lifestyle that wasn't making me happy was certainly another anchor. I don't think there's anything wrong with working a 9-to-5, but what I was doing wasn't in line with my values and beliefs. And so there's all these little, the big anchors and little anchors as well.
And you're writing them down. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Figuring out, you know, some of them were just bills that I had.
Yeah.
You know, the satellite radio I was paying for that was $20 a month that I wasn't ever listening to because I was listening to NPR. and so, you know, I had all of these things that were like, wait a minute, why am I so focused on these? These are the things I'm focused on. When these aren't the things that make me happy, the things that make me happy, I give them lip service. I say they're my real priorities. But they're just lip service priorities. Our real priorities are how we spend our time. And so if I'm incessantly checking Facebook or email or anything like that, those are the things that are my real priorities. When I said I was passionate about writing or I was really focused on my health or relationships, that wasn't true because I wasn't dedicating my time to those activities.
So all of this you talk about in one of your books, that so you go through the inventory, you identify your anchors, and then you have to make the hard decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it really started for both of us with a like, wants, needs list.
Yeah.
So when I went through these anchors, I really had to be honest with myself and ask, okay, out of these anchors, what are things that I like that I don't necessarily want or, you know, definitely don't need in my life, but I just like them, like going out to happy hour and racking up a large bar tab, or satellite TV, or satellite radio. Those are likes, don't necessarily need them. You know, the wants were things like having a 2,000 square foot condo. Yeah, sure, I need a roof over my head. I need electricity. I do need a hot shower. You know, those are things that I need, but I certainly don't need 2,000 square feet, 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, 2 living rooms to accomplish that. Same thing with a car. I don't need a new car, you know, $500-$700 a month payment. I do need a car in the Midwest. You got to have a car. So, you know, it was things like that where I really had to be honest with myself and see where I could let go of items. And right away, I could eliminate 100% of my needs. It was very easy to look at my needs and say, okay, I'm going to get rid of these things that I know that really don't make me that happy, and I really don't want them. They're just kind of there because I can afford them. And then I really went through my wants and eliminated, 80, 90% of those. It was difficult, especially, selling my condo and I actually rented it out. Selling my car and getting lower payments there. But yeah, it was really helpful. The likes, wants, and needs list really helped me kind of determine which anchors I needed to get rid of and which were the easiest to get rid of.
It's Ryan Nicodemus. He and Joshua Fields Milburn, they are with us to talk about, their minimalism, essentially. Their most recent book is called Everything That Remains. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are considering this question. If you had to strip your life of stuff, the gadgets and the toys and the clothes, the non-essentials, what would be left? It's an exercise that makes you really think about the things that matter, the things you need, not want. A few years ago, Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus got to thinking about the question. In fact, it made them change their lives. They quit their careers and pretty much ditched everything that didn't add value to their lives. They didn't come to live as monks, by the way. They just started thinking about living more fully with less. So, Joshua, I wanted to talk about you went through your mother's belongings after mm-hmm. she died, which seems like it was kind of another turning point. And there's this moment where she has a lot of stuff. She had good taste, but she had tons of stuff in her apartment, talk about. And then you find the stuff in the crawl space, these boxes that were sealed up. Mm-hmm. And these were sentimental things, but it seemed to be really telling. I mean, she hadn't opened them.
Right. They hadn't been accessed for probably 20 years. So I realized that as I was going through mom's stuff, and she wasn't a hoarder, like you said, but she had about 3 apartments worth of stuff in her one apartment. It was just 65 years worth of accumulations. And so as I was going through her stuff, I found those 4 boxes, and they were sealed. And I wonder what was in them, because they were labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, which sounds like a really bad mystery novel now. But and clearly, they hadn't been accessed for decades. Yeah. And so I opened them up, and it was my old elementary school paperwork. And I got a little frustrated at first, and I said, well, why was mom holding on to these? And clearly, I wasn't in the boxes. She wasn't accessing them. She wasn't getting any value from them. And then I realized that I was kind of doing the same thing, though, except instead of putting all her stuff in a box under my bed, I had rented a very large storage locker back in Ohio, and I was going to bring all of her stuff from Florida, where she was living, to Ohio and just put it in a huge box with a padlock. And if I'm honest with myself, I wasn't ever going to access it. I wasn't going to get any value from it. And so I realized 2 things there. Once I realized I was doing the same thing, I realized, number one, one of the biggest realizations I ever had regarding material possessions was our memories aren't in the things. That's why mom was holding on to that stuff. She was trying to hold on to the memories of me. But the memories were always in her. They were never in the things. Our memories are in us. And the second thing I realized is that other people can actually get value from the stuff. I wasn't going to get any value from it, but some of the things that I donated, other people got value from. A few of the things, antique furniture, I sold and was able to help 2 of the charities that really helped her with her chemo and her radiation, and realized that, wow, other people can actually get value from this stuff. And I do think that sometimes things can trigger memories, and I think that's an important distinction to make. So I took pictures of a lot of her things, and you can actually trigger the memories that way as opposed to holding on to something in a storage locker.
Well, you do point out that you don't believe sentimental items are bad. You don't have to get rid of everything. Some of those triggers are nice, some are not. So you don't have to ditch everything.
Right.
But the point is, I guess, that we are – our memories, as you say, it's not under our beds.
Right. And I find you can actually get more value from the sentimental things you hold on to if you use them and you display them. You put them in your home in a place where if you hold on to 1 or 2 or 3 sentimental items, those things take on a lot more meaning in a good way because they're great triggers, they're great memories, and you can get use out of those sentimental items if you have 1 or 2 or 3 that really mean something to you.
Here's an email from Howard, who writes, I'm connecting with much of your guests today, what they're talking about, but it also gives me a certain sense of unease. Mm. Are these questions about personal happiness and freedom ones only the most privileged among us can ask ourselves? Mm. Aren't many of people in this country and around the world saddled with minimalist constraints and yet still profoundly unhappy? Which is a question you probably get from time to time. I mean, you had this realization, and I'm trying to think about where it was, but you had this realization that minimalism wasn't just for single, young, white guys.
Right.
Talk a little bit about this question, because I think it's a good one.
Yeah, well, for me, it was actually a very important one. When the first guy I saw was that guy Colin Wright, who owned a bag full of things, lived out of a backpack, essentially, which was great for him. He was a young entrepreneur. He traveled to a new country every 4 months. I didn't have a desire to be a peripatetic writer and go over the world, but I realized that there were all these different flavors of minimalism, and that my flavor of minimalism would look different from theirs versus Joshua Becker versus Courtney Carver, the people that we mentioned already. But my flavor of minimalism would be right for me. It's like a recipe, right? I can tweeze out the ingredients that work for me. And the thing that I would say is that minimalism is applicable no matter where you are on the socioeconomic ladder. It's really about making better decisions with the resources you do have. If you have a lot of money, you can be a minimalist. If you don't have any money, you can be a minimalist, and vice versa. I used to make a lot of money, but I spent it in the wrong way. I wasn't very deliberate with it. And so ultimately, it's about making some deliberate choices with our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say that I've been lucky enough to kind of been on both sides of the spectrum, where I grew up in those, you know, in the poor circumstances, and was always in want, and money was always a form of discontent in the household. And then I was able to, you know, have everything I ever wanted by the time I was 28. And, you know, I think really where minimalism can help people is to really figure out why they want the things they want. Mm. So even if someone is in a position where, you know, they're not overwhelmed with, you know, a new car or a 2,000 square foot condo, but they find themselves wanting that, minimalism can help them really get to the root of why they actually want those things. Because growing up, even when I was, you know, approaching 28, I thought, man, you know, the next step is I want to be a millionaire. And then, you know, when I kind of had this explosion, when all of that pressure built up and exploded, and I didn't know what was important anymore, I thought, why do I want $1 million? What is $1 million really going to give me? All I knew was that, well, $1 million seems to make other people happy. Maybe $1 million will make me happy. But the truth is, I didn't know what I was going to do with that $1 million. And where minimalism really, you know, took me is, and we wrote about this in our first book, Minimalism, Live a Meaningful Life. Once we got past the stuff, once we got the clutter out of the way, you know, we really found that there were five areas that really we focused on to make ourselves happy. And I think anyone can learn from this. The first area that we talk about is health. When I found that when I was unhealthy, I was depressed. And I think that goes for most people. Unhealthy equals depression.
Yeah.
Relationships. Josh talked about that earlier. I lived a half hour away from my mother. I saw her 6 or 7 times a year because I was putting that relationship off to hang out with potential clients, to hang out with people who I can network with to get deeper into the community, more, you know, more influential, more influence in the community. I was hanging out with people who could potentially help me get a promotion. I wasn't spending time with people who meant the most to me. And, you know, I always told myself, well, one day I'm going to have enough money. One day I'm going to save up enough, and I'm going to be able to spend the time I want to spend with the people that I care about most. Maybe I'll be really lucky and retire when I'm 50 or 55, and then I can spend time doing that. And I realized after that packing party, like, wait a minute, if I minimize my life, if I own less, if I spend less, I don't have to work as much. I don't have to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and I can reclaim some of that time. And then the third thing we talk about is cultivating a passion. You know, a lot of people find themselves caught in that 9 to 5, get up, go to work, come home, eat dinner, watch TV, go to bed, get up, come home, go to work. And so many people are caught in that, and they live their lives for the weekends. They live their lives for the evenings. And I was certainly one of those people, the little time that I did have free during the week. And I used that time to be unhealthy, to slack off, to to cultivate bad habits because I deserved it because I worked so hard.
Yeah.
But really, I found that the discontent can come from dedicating your life to something that you're really not passionate about. So cultivating a passion is, it can really help people because there's nothing wrong with working a 9-to-5.
No.
We all have to pay the bills.
And you also point out that it's not just – people don't just have one passion.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, you can be passionate about multiple things. And that's the beauty of it is no one – you weren't born to be a radio host. We weren't born to be minimalists. There are many things that we can be passionate about. And I really feel and I know that if people can spend time each week dedicated to themselves, they can kind of take the edge off of that 9-to-5 cycle. And then real quick, the last two things that we talked about kind of go hand in hand. Growth – and contribution. Every single one of us in the world, we all have this intrinsic desire to grow. That is why kids will graduate high school, go to college, get a girlfriend, graduate college, buy a house, have a kid, buy a bigger house, get a promotion, buy a bigger house, have more kids, go on vacation. These are all growth experiences. And we all need that. And Josh and I found that really we grow the most when we contribute beyond ourselves.
One of the things you say about contributions is contribution doesn't mean just writing a check.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that can be important sometimes. And to take the money you do have, the resource you have, and help someone else who needs it. But I feel that you grow more as an individual. I know that when Ryan and I first started doing some things at soup kitchens or Habitat for Humanity and sort of putting some elbow grease into it, right? But there are other ways to contribute as well. I mean, right now we're on a 100-city book tour. We don't make any money from doing a 100-city book tour. We've been fortunate enough to have good-sized crowds, but our tour bus is a 12-year-old Toyota Corolla.
Right.
And so we're out here just spreading a message that has really helped us and changed our lives. We're dedicating 10 months of our lives to get out here and showing people that here's another recipe that might work for you. We're not proselytizing. We're not saying, you should be a minimalist. We're saying, here's something that worked for us. Find out what ingredients might work for you.
One of the things you talk about in terms of passions is you identified these four anchors that have kept you from pursuing your passions. And I wanted to go through a couple of these. One of them is identity.
Mm.
What is it about identity that keeps you from pursuing a passion, do you think?
You know, it's funny. People used to, or they still ask us now, what was the hardest thing to get rid of? And I guess they're expecting me to say like some big screen TV or something like that. And so there were many material items that were very hard to get rid of, especially at first. But the hardest thing for me to get rid of was my identity. And I don't mean like Jason Bourne getting, changing my name. But like I was so tied to that title that was printed on my business card, so tethered to that. Because it's the first question we ask people, right, is what do you do? And I think it's an incredibly pernicious, dangerous question because, first off, it's a very broad question. You know, because I do a lot of things. I wear blue jeans. I drink water. I walk down the street. What we're really saying is, where do you work? How much money do you earn? So I can compare the two of us on the socioeconomic ladder. But when you posit the question that way, it becomes a lot more obvious what we're trying to talk about. And so I found the way that I changed my answer to that question was I would tell people what I was passionate about instead of what I did to earn a paycheck because I didn't hate my job, but I wasn't that passionate about it either. And why would I want to talk about something I was dispassionate about? And so I would say I'm really passionate about writing. I wouldn't say I was a writer because then you get the accusatory questions. You get the questions, really, how many books have you written?
Yeah.
Who's your publicist? And you get all of these questions. So I would say I'm really passionate about writing. And I flip the question around. I say, what are you passionate about? Totally changed the trajectory of our conversations. And it also helped me no longer stay wrapped up in that identity of here's my job title.
Here's another one, another anchor, which I thought was interesting that kept you from pursuing passions, certainty.
Mm.
What does that mean?
Well, I think every person needs a level of certainty in their life. We have to be certain that we can sit in this building and the roof isn't going to collapse in on us. Be certain that we can eat every day, certain that we can go home and take a hot shower. I mean, there are these levels of certainty.
But some stuff gets paralyzing. Mm-hmm. If it goes too far.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really where that anchor came into play with certainty is I was associating certainty with my identity with my job title, certainty with this six-figure income that I had, certainty with the house, with all these material possessions, with this compulsory consumption. This was my certain it gave me certainty that I was going to be happy if I continued to live my life this way. So we really had to take a hard look at what was certainty to us. And for Josh and I both, I mean, that's different. And it would be different for everyone who really takes a look
at
it.
Well, that is one of the takeaways, I think, from the whole idea is this is really personal. Yeah. Everyone is different in terms of the thing that when they really strip it down to the most essential, it's completely personal, what you have left, right?
It'd be really great and easy if I could say, here are the 100 items you're supposed to own, and you'll be happy. Yeah. I wish
you have a kid, you have 30 items each.
Yeah. Right.
But you're right. It is such a highly individual question that we have to ask it of ourselves. And so my situation is going to be different from yours.
Let's go to the phones. Shelley is with us in Springville. Shelley, hi.
Hi. I absolutely love the idea of minimalism. And when it comes to making purchasing decisions for myself, I definitely keep that in mind. But I have 4 children under the age of 5, and they have so much stuff. Binkies and strollers and car seats and toys and bicycles, and I hate it. It drives me crazy. But I feel like so much of it is useful and necessary. I wondered if you had any suggestions for minimalist parenting.
That's your next book, guys.
Yes. Well, Shelley, it's so easy for me to give advice on kids when I have none myself. So let me give it to you. Now, first, I do want to say Joshua Becker, a guy I mentioned earlier, he just wrote a book called Clutter Free with Kids, and it addresses situations just like this. So I would certainly recommend that book. But, you know, we had a reader who was at one of our events, and this question came up, and, you know, we kind of recommended Clutter Free with Kids, and someone had raised their hand and they said, you know, what I do with my children is I make sure to never tell them no. I always tell them yes. So little Johnny goes, to his mom and says, hey, I really want a new bike, or I really want a new Power Ranger, or I really want, another transformer, whatever it may be. She'll say, okay, we can certainly consider making that decision. But before we decide on what we're going to get, let's decide on what you're going to get rid of. So it's kind of this one in, one out philosophy that she uses with her children. I thought that was a great approach. She did the same thing with her daughter's artwork. Her daughter is so proud of her artwork and wants to display it on the fridge. And the mother didn't want to hold on to boxes of artwork. So every time she would come home and say, oh, look at this new drawing. That's a very beautiful drawing. Let's go ahead and put it up on the fridge. Which one do you want to take down? And kind of had that approach. So that would be my advice.
Yeah. Shelley, there are a few. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Let's see. Tina with us in Huntington, Utah. Tina, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my story of having to minimalize my life out of necessity and not out of choice, but how I found the joy and the peace that they're talking about. We bought a farm and had to move over before there was any kind of basic living conditions. So with our 5 children, we moved into an old fifth wheel trailer and packed everything away. And I cooked on a fry pan and a crock pot for 7 months before we were able to expand our living conditions into a 16-by-16-foot room. And as we have discovered what we don't need and how happy my children are without all the excess and with the one toy and the trading things out, like your guest was just saying, when they want something new, we really don't have room for anything else. And so I say, what are you going to get rid of? Mm. And there's so much less housework. There's so much less of everything that I have time to really spend with my children and enjoy them. And I can now when I go, we've started building our a home, and we've designed it very simply. And when I go to those storage units to unpack, I know I'm going to throw away half the stuff that's in there because I haven't used it in 2 years.
Yes.
You must hear this kind of thing all the time, right? I mean, this idea that, you know, that they I guess it goes back to the packing party in some way. It's the, you know, you out of circumstance or out of whatever else, you're forced to not use certain things, and you realize you didn't really need them in the first place. I guess you guys hear this all the time.
And often we hear people that go back and they say, the happiest time of my life was when I was going off to college and everything I owned could fit into my car. And while I'm not advocating that particular lifestyle, I think it's a clue. It's a clue toward, well, wait a minute. I was focused on a particular direction, and the direction didn't involve the accumulation of stuff in my life.
Chad sends us this Twitter. He says, voluntary steps toward minimalism have allowed my wife and me to be more generous with time and money. Mm-hmm. Jeremy says, even the shelves of video games from 10 years ago or more, books we'll probably never read, CDs, mementos. These are things that they would get rid of. Christy says, cough, empty software and game stem boxes. Cough. From Scott, he writes, here's a phrase that I find myself coming back to time and time again. Don't spoil the things you have with the things you don't have. I'll get back to some of those when we come back from the break. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's really nice. I think, to Tina, the last caller, and some of the Twitters, the tweets there, I guess. That's what the kids are calling these days.
The kids.
from some of those tweets. Those are, some really great answers to the question of, how might your life be better if you own less stuff?
That's Ryan Nicodemus. He and Joshua Fields Milburn, their latest book is called Everything That Remains. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus. They're known as the Minimalists. Scott is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Scott. Hi.
Yeah, I just had a comment quickly. I've been talking about this same thing with my boy the last week, and I've been just trying to instill upon him that, it's not necessarily about being a minimalist. It's just about, spend the time with computers and all that kind of stuff. Just like be an individual and spend your time answering these questions for yourself and what really does make you happy, not what's going to make you successful and rich and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so this has been really important. And it's just interesting that I'm glad he's at that point where he's starting to come back to that thing of questioning what's going on.
Well, it's interesting. You guys had this conversation as 10-year-old kids. I mean, you were having conversations, and I'm guessing people are having these same kinds of conversations, which get at that thing. Gosh, what are we doing? What's making us happy?
Sure. And ultimately, what we're talking about is the benefits of simplifying or minimalism, whatever you want to call it. We were on a conversation with our friend Leo, who has 6 kids, and I find that it's true whether you have kids or you're single or whatever. Ultimately, it's about the benefits, right? Before the break, Ryan asked a question, how might your life be better if you own less stuff? And really, that's the question that I asked myself to get leverage so I could figure out, okay, why am I doing this? Because we all know how to declutter. We all know how to remove items from our closet. The purpose, the why to, is so much more important.
Yeah.
Why am I doing this? Oh, it's because maybe I'll have more money, or my house will be easier to clean, so I'll have more time to spend with my family. I'll have more time to do things I'm passionate about. Understanding those benefits, and they're different for everyone.
Right.
The benefits for me was reclaiming my time and getting back control of my finances. But other people, quite often, it's, wow, it's so much easier just to clean my house, which is a huge benefit when you think about it.
Let's go back to the phones. Scott, thanks. Tristan is with us in Pleasant Grove. Tristan, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a quick comment for the two gentlemen. I think what you guys are doing is absolutely wonderful. I just wanted to share an experience, just my own personal experience. At a young age, at around 20, I lost everything I owned twice. And I mean, these are,
wow,
personal effects, pictures, books, things like that, that I thought, really sum me up of who I was. And then, in the moment I was terrified, really scared, angry. But after, I take a deep breath and I realize, well, I'm still here. I'm still alive. I'm free, and these things didn't define who I was or my existence even, And that was something powerful for me.
Yeah, there's the Chuck Palahniuk line about it's not until you get rid of everything that you're free to do anything. And that tends to resonate.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Let's go back to the phones. Ellen is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I would like to comment on this process as part of aging. The idea of moving or transitioning your life from all of the things you had and did when you were fully employed in the prime of life and moving into those things you keep or you focus on as you age. And one of the most difficult parts of that transition for me has been to understand that this is not a relinquishment or a giving up or something of becoming poverty-stricken, if you will, and of giving away everything, that it is, it's a process of deepening. I had to get over the idea that I was, that it was depriving myself of all the things I had, and move into an understanding that it was not relinquishment, it was a positive move into a new phase of life. Who are you and what do you have around you when you are not who you have been, became the question for me.
I think that's a great point. That certainly is the process I had to go through when I was giving up the new car and the job and the house, that it wasn't a relinquishment, that I was, by giving that stuff up, by saying no to those things, I was saying yes to other things for my life. And I think that we could learn a lot from what she had to say, because I think a lot of people are in that situation where they do feel like they're stuck. They feel like they can't go backwards because they're giving up this, big job title, or they're just giving up this identity, whatever it may be. And I think it's important to realize that, yeah, you're saying no to certain things so you can't say yes to others.
Well, so what's the stuff you kept? Which one of you kept the mountain bike?
I don't have a mountain bike. I have a snowboard.
Oh.
I actually do have a mountain bike. It's on loan right now. The gentleman has not asked for it back yet, so I am still borrowing it. But that is something that I need in Missoula, Montana. And I'm glad you asked about that because, just to the point of minimalism is not about deprivation. It's really about focusing on the things that make you truly happy. I love to snowboard. I love it. I absolutely love it. That's why it's one of the main reasons why I moved to Montana, is because I live in Missoula, and within an hour, there are 5 different resorts that I can go to and just have a ball. And those are things that I really enjoy and that really help me grow, and things that I'm passionate about. And along with the snowboard comes all the snowboarding gear. Now, I don't have 2 jackets or 2 pairs of snow pants or multiple snowboards or multiple bindings and all the other stuff that comes with it. I make sure that I have what I need, but I'm still able to live a very fulfilled, very happy life.
What about you? Stuff that you kept.
I like doing these little stoical experiments from time to time to test myself to see what actually adds value to my life. And so there isn't much that I kept from yesteryear, but occasionally I'll get rid of things to figure out whether or not I want to bring it back into my life. Sometimes that's like TV at home or internet at home. I got rid of that for a month and just ended up never getting it back because it was the most productive month of my life.
Wait, internet?
Internet at home.
So because you had internet at the office.
Right. And so
but you didn't need it at home.
Yeah, well, I decided that I figured out that I was pacifying myself with it. It was really easy to get at those little ephemeral bursts, those little food pellets. It's like a lab rat that's trapped and keeps hitting that lever to get the food. Hit the lever, get the food. Hit the lever, get the food. And I realized that's kind of what I was doing with every Facebook like or tweet or whatever. And even with my cell phone, I got rid of my cell phone for 2 months and realized it was a wonderful tool that I could reincorporate back into my life, but in a different way. I no longer have Facebook on my cell phone. I no longer have email on my cell phone, but I use it for things like GPS or...
Well, you use it for...
To make a phone call, too. Isn't that amazing?
Imagine that.
Yeah, no, but I like to remove things temporarily deprive myself to figure out what can I get value from. Because as a minimalist now, everything I own serves a purpose or brings me joy, and everything else is gone. But the cool thing is that changes over time, even for me as an individual. It's highly individual, but it's also individual for my current self versus my future self. So I have to ask that question. Does this add value to my life today? And then tomorrow, just because it added value to my life today, it may not tomorrow. So I have to keep asking that question. Does this thing add value to my life?
I kind of feel that way about books for me. Yeah. Like books, I love books. Love reading them. And for a long time, I loved just having them. I still have lots of stacks. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of the work that I'm in. But I love the idea of we give them away after we use them for the show. We give them away because someone – it's like with your mom,
Right.
Someone else can make use of this. It just – because it seemed like such a trophy.
Yeah. I used to have 2,000 books and a big bookshelf to display them. And then I realized that oh, I have this many books because it makes me look kind of smart.
Yeah, exactly.
And I haven't read most of them. Yeah. And I was compensating. I don't have a college degree, so I was, oh, look at all the books I've read. But I still have books now, but I have a well-curated collection, the books I really get value from and books I like to lend out to people. In fact, I'll say I still have 2,000 books. They're just in other people's hands now.
Yeah.
And other people are actually getting value from them as opposed to them decorating my wall.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's funny. People always come up to us at an event inevitably, and someone will say, I'm not a minimalist like you because I've got this book collection I can't get rid of. I just love the books. I love the way they smell. I love the experience of turning the pages. I love lending them out to friends, and then they bring them back, and we have conversations about the books. And I'll say, it sounds like you get a lot of value out of those books, and it makes you happy. Keep your books. It's okay. I was like Josh. I had a lot of books, but I wasn't getting that much value out of them. Now I have a well-curated book selection.
Ryan Nicodemus and Joshua Fields Milburn are the Minimalists. Their most recent book is called Everything That Remains. Guys, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Help today, of course, from Michael Havey and Lewis Downey. Thanks, guys. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.